Welcome to The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker-Scott, Associate Professor and Extension Urban Horticulturist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, I'm Linda Chalker-Scott, and welcome back to Season 3 of The Informed Gardener. It's our spring season, and the podcast is growing along with our gardens. This year, we're going to shake things up a bit by having more of an interactive approach. We'd love to get your questions for our Q&A segment at the end of the show. Just drop us an email and give us an idea or two. Meanwhile, let's get busy with spring cleaning. It's finally spring, and in some parts of the country, it's come a lot earlier than usual. So spring cleaning's in order, both inside and out, and that includes garden weeds. Later on, I'll be sharing some information about an organic form of weed control called corn gluten meal that may or may not work for your garden. And I'll also have some spring gardening tips. But first, let's look at some spring-related garden stories in the news.
He was walking in the garden.
Our first story is from ScienceDaily.com, one of my favorite spots to get science about plants. And this story is called Spring's Rising Soil Temperatures See Hormones Wake Seeds from Their Winter Slumber. There's what's called a weed seed bank in your garden, and spring makes a big withdrawal from that seed bank. But what exactly is it that determines whether or not you're going to have weeds growing this year, or next year, or maybe 10 years, or maybe 100 years? Well, there's some new research from the University of Warwick in the United Kingdom to help us understand how seed germination works, especially those pesky weeds. So the seeds lay dormant in your garden soil, just waiting for the right cues to start growing in the springtime. And it turns out that what they're waiting for is a change in soil temperature. So the first signal is that the soil is warming up, and that starts this whole cascade system. That change in temperature then changes the plant's sensitivity to its own hormones. And there's a couple different hormones that are important in keeping a plant dormant or allowing the seed to germinate. There are two hormones involved in this process that interact with each other, and one of them is inhibitory. It's called abscisic acid, we'll just call it ABA for short, and the other one's gibberellic acid. It's a stimulatory hormone, and we'll call it GA. So we've got ABA, which is inhibitory, and GA, which is stimulatory. So it's a balance between these two hormones in the seed that determines whether or not it's going to stay dormant or whether it's going to start growing. Once it gets this temperature signal that the soil's warming up, the amounts of this hormone shift so that the inhibitory one, the ABA, starts going downhill and GA starts going uphill in terms of concentration. So you get more and more of the GA, it's more stimulatory, and then the plant starts to grow again. So it's when it loses its dormancy, it starts to allow water to come in, it swells and it begins to grow. So this is the point when the plant has really put all of its eggs in one basket, so to speak, and decided it's going to grow rather than to stay dormant. So at this point, there's no turning back. And this is what's kind of useful for those of us who are trying to control weeds, is if we understand this process, which is now, you know, just being understood in terms of this cascade effect, it'll be easier to figure out how to keep the weeds out by understanding the processes behind seed germination rather than using herbicides and other types of control that aren't so nice for the environment. So what you can do with this right now, even though the research isn't finished yet, is understand that in sunnier sites in your garden, the soil is warmer, and you're going to get seeds growing there more quickly than you will in the cooler, shadier sites. Also, soil that's mulched stays cooler longer than unprotected soil. So knowing a little bit about the temperature differences in your garden can help you predict when the weeds will start coming up, and you can take evasive action before they appear.
Gardening at night.
So staying along with our little story of weeds, we're going to move on to the golf courses now, because along with spring comes the multicolored golfing pants that we see. So they're out there in contrast with all the flowers. Before we get started on this story about golf course weeds, I need to know whether or not you know why gardeners in the golf course carry an extra pair of gloves in their back pocket. And it's just in case they get a hole in one. But we'll go to maybe a less amusing subject, and this subject is the use of herbicides on golf courses to keep the weeds out. Now, those of you that are golfers know that you have to have a nice, clean, uniform, especially putting green, but fairways as well, so the ball rolls right along. And there's a lot of weeds that'll pop up and create little patches where the ball won't roll. So golf course managers for years have been keeping weeds out with glyphosate, which many of you will recognize as Roundup. And this is something that kills weeds pretty thoroughly. relatively speaking, it's a safe herbicide as herbicides go, and it's pretty economical. So it's been pretty much the method of choice for killing weeds in golf courses. Well, unfortunately, when you use the same thing over and over and over and over, weeds just don't sit there and take it. What they do is they mutate, they change, they evolve. They develop genes that are resistant to these chemicals. So what we're finding now in golf courses is that some of these, especially the annual bluegrass weeds, are becoming resistant. So we spray them with Roundup and they laugh at Roundup. They will not die. They did a really interesting study in Tennessee where they've been using Roundup for about 20 years to kill the annual bluegrass. They were finding that spray and spray and spray they might, and the bluegrass would just come back even with more fervor than before. So they collected some of the seeds from these plants, they grew them up in the greenhouse, and then they compared them to some susceptible annual bluegrass plants that came from another population. And this was just fascinating. They sprayed them with several concentrations of Roundup to find out how much Roundup it actually took to kill these plants. So we have two populations of these plants for an experiment. One of them is a resistant population that came from these seeds that were collected from the Tennessee golf course where they'd sprayed Roundup for almost 20 years. So they had Roundup diets for almost 20 years. And the other was a population of annual bluegrass that had never experienced Roundup in their entire little green lives. And so they would obviously have no previous experience with it. So they tried spraying these populations with different concentrations of Roundup, and with the susceptible population, this is the one that was never exposed to Roundup ever, 95% of them died after being sprayed with only half the strength concentration usually used at the golf course to control weeds. So, you know, weren't killed by very much at all. But with the ones that came from the golf course where they had experienced Roundup spraying every spring for almost the last 20 years, it took 8 times the amount of what's normally sprayed to only kill 76% of them. So even with 8 times more than normal, 24% of the plants still live. So these are grasses that just laugh at Roundup and drink it happily and aren't affected by it at all. So they truly are resistant to it. So obviously over these 20 years, the population has become very resistant, and this happens because you have certain groups of genes that become more dominant and allow the plant to survive this particular insult. So obviously what needs to happen in terms of these golf courses in Tennessee, as well as probably other golf courses and maybe even your own garden, is we need to be a lot more sensitive about when we use Roundup. Roundup is a great tool. It works really well if it's not overused. And obviously if you use it too much, then things do become resistant to it. So we need to use IPM more, and that stands for Integrated Pest Management. So that means that instead of just automatically spraying weeds with the most toxic chemical you can come up with, maybe what you do is you use mulch, or maybe you do a little bit of hand weeding. So maybe those gardening gloves for the golf course gardeners aren't such a joke after all. I saw you in the garden, baby. You look so debonair. Beware of the flowers, because I'm sure they're going to get you. Yeah. Well, in keeping with our theme of spring cleaning and spring cleaning those nasty weeds in our garden, this week's myth is on corn gluten meal, which is a really interesting product. I love using products that are some kind of waste material that comes from processing or some other kind of industrial usage. So rather than going to landfill, there's material that comes from milling corn that's called corn gluten meal. So it's the protein part. So you know that if you de-germ wheat to get flour, you know, you've got wheat germ left over. With corn, it's corn gluten meal. And it used to be used mostly as kind of a filler for livestock feed and not really much of anything else. It also turns out to have very good activity against germinating seeds. So it gets used as an herbicide. In fact, it's registered to use in turf as a natural type of pre-emergent herbicide. And a pre-emergent herbicide is just one that you put down before the weeds come up, and then it kills them as they come up. So it's really safe to use around plants that are already established and are rooted. It doesn't affect them at all. In fact, it acts as a really nice fertilizer for them because it has a lot of nitrogen. But if you put it around seeds that are just starting to germinate, so maybe back, we're talking about that seed bank in your garden and it's just gotten warm enough and they're starting to imbibe water, these are the seeds that the corn gluten meal will work against really effectively. So it's not a selective herbicide. In other words, it will kill good plants and bad plants. So you don't want to be using it when you have vegetable seeds that you're growing or annual seeds because it'll take those out along with the weed seeds. The way it works isn't really well understood yet. There's a couple different ways. There apparently is a protein in there that has some kind of inhibitory activity. But one of the main things it does is it dehydrates the seeds. So it kind of acts like a natural sponge. Let's say you've got your weed seeds there, soil's warming up, it's nice and moist, the seeds start to swell as they're germinating, and then this corn gluten meal goes down and it just sucks the moisture right out of the seedling and kills it. So it works really well. It's a natural product, and it was developed in Iowa, at Iowa State University, as a matter of fact, where they've had very good success in using it in a number of different applications. But here's a weird thing. I live in Seattle, and it won't work here. It won't work in Western Oregon. It won't work in Western California. And the reason is because we don't have the same type of climate as Iowa does. So you have to kind of look at climate differences. When we apply this and it's as a weed control and we're using it in the springtime, what's tricky with it is that it has to remain dry after it's applied. Now, if you happen to live in my part of the country right now, it hasn't stopped raining for what? 3 months, 4 months? It's raining all the time. So you can put this stuff down and it's not going to do any good at all. It's going to absorb water till it bursts because there's just so much rainwater. It's not going to dry the seeds out. But in Iowa, their springs are really pretty dry and they get most of their rainfall in the summer. So the springs are drier. You can put this down and it's very effective because it doesn't rain so often. So it's not really a myth because it does work, but it is a myth to think it works everywhere well. It will not. I would encourage people to try it. It's a natural product. But again, remembering that it may not work in your situation, especially if you can't keep the area dry after you've put it down. And the funny thing is that if it doesn't stay dry, it acts as a natural fertilizer. And the tests that have been done on this with crabgrass, especially when they've looked at the crabgrass that's been treated with it, the crabgrass goes crazy because it's so nice and moist here. And then having this nice high nitrogen material around it, and they just are the happiest little crabgrass plants you've ever seen. So I would recommend other types of weed control for our part of the country. Mulching worked well. Sub-irrigation, which is the same thing as soaker hoses, where you just have the water that comes from the roots and goes up rather than coming from the top down. Those are better ways of keeping the weeds out.
In the hanging garden, please don't speak. In the hanging garden, no one sleeps.
Anyway, just to reiterate, if you live in the western part of the United States, corn gluten meal is kind of fun to play with. If you can predict your weather better than the weatherman, you might be able to be lucky and keep the weeds out if you have a stretch of dry weather after you've applied it. But otherwise, it's not a magic bullet for us, and I would certainly recommend using mulch. A little tried, true, maybe boring, but definitely very effective.
See them drifts upon the
So just to wrap up today's podcast, I wanted to leave you with some seasonal garden tips. When I did this last time, it was in the winter when we were putting our gardens to bed, and now it's time to shake them awake. Come on, it's time to go. And we've got the three P's. We're going to pick them up. And this is getting rid of the vegetation that's still hanging around from last year. Now, some of this you can leave. Absolutely should leave as much on the land as you can because those nutrients go right back into the soil. But I'm talking about those really stiff flower stalks, maybe from your hostas or maybe the irises, and they just lay there like giant pieces of straw, and they really aren't very attractive and it takes a long time to break down. Same thing with some leaves. Rhododendron leaves, for example, just take forever to break down. So, you know, don't throw them away. Absolutely, you want to compost them, but I usually pick them up just because I don't like the way they look. Okay, there I said it. I have an aesthetic sense too. I can't help myself. So I just take those things and I toss them. The second tip is prepare. And this is preparing your soil for eventual planting. You don't know exactly yet what you're going to buy and where you're going to put it. But in the meantime, you need to make sure the weeds don't get started. So you need to get the mulch down. Keep the soil covered. You can consider it a placeholder. It just keeps the weeds out, waiting for the good plants to go in. And that way you'll have a lot less weeding to do when you're finally ready to plant whatever it is you end up buying. And then finally, the planting part, the fun part. And this is the annuals, the vegetables, the bulbs, especially those for fall flowering, a lot of the herbaceous perennials, just about anything you want. It's time to plant. I do recommend waiting on the trees and shrubs. It's best to plant them actually in the fall. But everything else, it's time to get out there and get busy and get that in there.
Because every day's a holiday in Mr. Moody's garden. Where little girls say pardon and how do.
So I really hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast, the first of our third season. Be sure to listen next time when our theme is going to be getting your money's worth. So I talked about planting, those annuals, the vegetables, the bulbs, the works. Now we're going to talk about how to pick out what you're going to plant. So that highlight's going to be an interview with my favorite plantsman, Riz Reyes, who's going to help you figure out how to get the biggest bloom for your buck. In the meantime, happy gardening. This podcast is only one of the ways I provide science-based information for use in your own garden. For more, be sure to visit my webpage, theinformedgardener.com. It's my official Washington State University webpage and is full of great and free information. You'll also find archived podcasts from our first and second seasons. Second, please join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professors blog. You'll find it at gardenprofessors.com, where the four of us take on all kinds of gardening questions about any topic you can imagine, and you can add your own comments, and we will even respond to you. And finally, for those of you who will never give up books until they're pried from your cold, dead hands, I've written three books that might be of interest. The Informed Gardener, The Informed Gardener Blooms Again, and Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. You can find out more about these books at sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. In any case, I hope you found this podcast entertaining and useful. I welcome listener comments and questions, and you can reach me at lyndacs@wsu.edu.
You've been listening to The Informed Gardener. To catch this and other shows from previous seasons, go to theinformedgardener.com, mynorthwest.com, or search for us on iTunes. I have no reason.